Nothing is more important than getting a good night's sleep, and when you don't get the rest you need, your whole day is thrown off. That's why it's so important to choose the right mattress. Sleeping on a Purple mattress is truly a unique experience, because Purple mattresses are made with a GelFlex grid. The GelFlex grid is an innovative material that moves with your body to relieve pressure in areas like knees and hips, and support in others, like your back. It feels soft where you want it and supports where you need it. Purple mattresses instantly adapt when you move. You don't sink in and get stuck like with memory foam. And thanks to over 1,400 air chambers in the GelFlex grid, you will sleep cooler on a Purple mattress. Purple has a wide variety of mattresses, from the original Purple mattress to the Restore Hybrid Collection that combines GelFlex grid with coils, and the Rejuvenate Luxe Collection, the height of luxury, with over 112,000 five-star reviews to prove it. Visit purple.com to find the perfect Purple for you and enter code PODCAST10 to get 10% off. It's better over
here. AT&T customers, switching to T-Mobile has never been easier. We'll pay off your existing phone and give you a new one free, all on America's largest 5G network. Visit T-Mobile.com/carrierfreedom to switch today.
Pay off up to $650 via virtual prepaid MasterCard in 15 days. Free phone up to $830 via 24 monthly bill credits plus tax. Qualifying port-in trade-in service on Go5G Next and credit required. Contact us before canceling entire account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance and required finance agreement is due.
This show is sponsored by Midi Health. There are great things that come with age: wisdom, experience, and knowledge, just to name a few. But if you're a woman over 40, it can also bring some less desirable things like hot flashes, insomnia, brain fog, moodiness, and weight gain, all symptoms of menopause and perimenopause. Yes, hormonal transition is a fact of life, but that doesn't mean you have to accept its symptoms as just another part of aging. MIDI clinicians are menopause experts, equipped to support you with safe, effective, FDA-approved medications, as well as supplements, lifestyle coaching, and preventative health guidance. You'll come out of the experience feeling heard and with a plan to start feeling better. MIDI offers accessible care. All their services are covered by insurance, and they're conveniently accessible through telehealth visits and 24/7 messaging. You deserve to feel great. Book your virtual visit today at joinmidi.com. That's joinmidi.com.
Richard M. Daley was Chicago's longest-serving mayor, surpassing his father's time in that office, and his 22 years make for fascinating reading. And we'll hear about that from a similarly fascinating former public official, Forrest Claypool. Hello, I'm political editor Craig Delamore, and this is At Issue. The book is titled The Daley Show, Inside the Transformative Reign of Chicago's Richard M. Daley. The author is Forrest Claypool. Richard M. Daley was a state lawmaker, a Cook County state's attorney, and mayor. Claypool has an even longer resume. He was Mayor Daley's chief of staff for his first and third terms. He became one of the mayor's reliable troubleshooters. He was sent to the Chicago Park District to become its chief executive in 1993. He was the Chicago Transit Authority's president next and ran the public schools from 2015 to 2017. So, as you might imagine, he knew Rich Daley very well. And his book chronicles Daley's great successes, his missteps, his great impact, and his failures. Forrest Claypool, it's good to see you again.
Hey, thanks for having me, Craig.
Well, when people talk about political power in Chicago, they most often talk about the first Mayor Daley, Richard J. Daley. But, I mean, personally, I think Richard M.'s career paints a deeper and more complete picture of how power can be used and how it can turn. Am I reading that right?
No, absolutely. That's one of the themes of the book, is really that to be successful in governing a large and contentious city like Chicago, the adept and unapologetic use of power is critical. But also one of the themes of the book is that if that power is not sufficiently challenged, over time, it can tend towards corruption. And I think it's no accident that the major scandals on Daley's watch occurred later in his reign, when he had accumulated massive power and was his highest level of popularity, and really was reigning, you know, as Steve Chapman once said, like a monarch.
Mm. And we're going to get to that. I mean, politics was the family business in the Daley household. An old parlor game that reporters used to play was, all right, well, who was the better the better mayor, Richard J. or Richard M. And I always argued on the Richard M. side, and I won't say any other reporters who argued against me, but there were some fierce arguments we used to have, and it took an actual Daily to settle it, and it was Bill Daily who we put it to, and he said his brother, because his dad could not operate in today's politics, but his brother could do the old style politics and the new. And that's part of the beauty of his abilities, and maybe the trap of it was that he was comfortable adjusting to how you know, the new types of power.
Yeah, he was very resilient. And in fact, I talk about this in the book, how his father was the ultimate inside politician who accumulated power through the inside. And Daley himself, as the son, was sort of the prince in waiting, following a similar path until the cataclysm of Jane Byrne's election over Michael Bolandic as the head of the machine. And she in turn took over Daley's old machine and used it ruthlessly and targeted Richard M. Daley because she feared that he would succeed her. And as a result of that, Rich Daley had to play the outside game. He had to lead an unlikely insurgency against the very machine his father had built in order to win the state's attorney's race and overcome all the attacks from Jane Byrne, who was firing all of his allies and doing everything she could to undermine him. So it's kind of ironic that you had the two Daleys, one who had to be running on the outside as an insurgent, and that obviously his father was the ultimate inside politician.
Yeah, and as a prosecutor, Daley was a conservative law and order figure, vehemently against the drug trade. But on social issues, he was close, I mean, if not an ultra-liberal, certainly more liberal, pro-choice for LGBTQ rights. And you chronicle that is something that developed, wasn't it?
Yeah, and it surprised the heck out of his staff, because everyone, and even the public to some degree, because everyone just assumed that he was this devoutly religious conservative figure like his father, who went to mass every day, and whose base was a very conservative working class, mostly Catholic base on the Northwest and the Southwest side. So when he actually came out against abortion restrictions, it was kind of a shock. And of course, what's more interesting really to me was the fact that he was literally one of the first politicians in the country to come out in favor of gay rights and gay marriage, and in fact was the first Grand Marshal of the Gay Pride Parade in 1989. Which caused consternation among his more conservative advisors, but it was not only the right thing to do, it was a brilliant political stroke as well, because he expanded his own base and helped him going forward.
But was it just a political calculation? I got the impression, and I didn't cover him exclusively around that time, that there was something personal in there.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think his number one motivation was that it was the right thing to do. The fact that it had a corollary political benefit in the long run, and that he was prescient enough to see that, because at the time, everyone was afraid to come out in favor of gay rights. I mean, he was way ahead of the other politicians. For that reason, he's a member today of the Gay Rights Hall of Fame here in Chicago. So it was a risk. It took courage. So I do think that was the motivation, was his principles, but it turned out to be a significant benefit for him politically as well.
Yeah, and there were openly gay people within his administration too, and so that was something that we really hadn't seen much of before. Let's talk a little bit about style, and we could spend like the entire half hour talking about, you know, had the Harold Washington years and how he had to be on the outside and get back in. But let's focus on his administration. His style was unique. I mean, first off, he used to take notes in the back of his limo. I mean, when he would be driven places, making notes on potholes and streetlights and graffiti. That was a little bit more minutiae than mayors usually get to. What was going on there?
Well, you're right. It is, and still is. I mean, if you look at mayors today around the country, and Daley understood something that a lot of other leaders didn't, was as, it wasn't as those little things matter, because what matters in building a safe and growing city is its quality of life. And it's, and the quality of life starts with the little things. In other words, if your city is full of graffiti and the homeless on the streets and panhandling and the like, you know, it creates a sense of disorder and fear, and it also discourages business and discourages residents from coming downtown or to going to those areas. So he knew that cleaning up the city was priority number one to make it more livable and safe, and it worked. He drove violent crime down to 40-year lows, working with the community and driving that theory. There was a theory called broken windows theory that was actually advanced before by two professors and was credited for a lot of New York success, but the first city to practice broken windows theory wasn't New York. It was Chicago under Mayor Daley.
Mm. And to what extent did it work? And to what extent did that typify his style? Or was it just one of the things that he did?
It was at the core of everything he did, because at the core of everything was his desire for a sense of cleanliness and orderliness and safety, and an atmosphere that in the neighborhoods of one of, you know, where families could, there were amenities for everybody. There were all kinds of amenities that would keep people in the city. But it starts with the basic, the city being clean, the city being safe. So that's what really lays the groundwork for everything else. And so he started there and then built out into more sophisticated efforts, to make the city better, like his turnaround of the public schools, like his turnaround of the Chicago parks. The raising of the public housing high rises, and you know, those sorts of things.
And let's first talk about the schools, because that was I think a pivotal part of his reign. He ended up, maybe not because it was his idea, but getting more power than previous mayors had had over the schools. How did he get that, and how did it work out for him?
Yeah, and that's something I talk about in the book too. It's some of these things that he did. You know, what's remarkable is that how close they came to not happening. His power and control of the schools was only because for a 2-year window, the Republicans controlled both the House and the Senate and the governor's office after the 1994 Republican national wave, with Newt Gingrich and his contract with America and Bill Clinton's missteps on national health insurance. And so in that 2-year window of unfettered GOP rule, which has not been repeated since, the Republicans gave him control of the schools. And that if even one of the three branches of the government had remained with the Democrats, that never would have happened because of the power of the teachers union and other things. So it was unique. But once he had it in that 2 years, he dramatically began to reform the system so that it was such that then that no one was going to take it back from him, because you could see the enormous progress. And then the business community, the philanthropic community, not-for-profits, united in an effort with him over 25 years and two mayors to completely turn around Chicago public schools.
And I want to talk a little bit about him as a person, because one thing that I remember was, if you ever wanted to get Mayor Daley talking nonstop, ask him about education.
Yeah.
And that again was something that was personal for him. He could talk your ear off about education and theory, and he was really well read about that kind of stuff. And we should get this out of the way for everybody who said he couldn't, you know, he was couldn't talk and sounded like he didn't know what he was talking about. First off, he just had a stage fright talking in public, but he really knew subjects and could really discuss education more than anything I remember. But what was driving that?
Yeah, he did have certain things where he was deeply, deeply passionate about. He was obviously, he had a love for his city like his father did. And he wore it on his sleeve, and that drove him. But you're right, education probably was number one, because he really, I think, identified with kids and those that didn't have the same opportunities as others, and And he saw it as an opportunity to advance their future, their for generations of kids, but and also what that meant for the city. I mean, you advance the fortune of those kids, but you also bring middle class parents back into the city, which adds economic stability. You know, they had flipped me in middle class parents. And when I first went came to the city, you know, my neighbors across the street at age five, they would pick up, put the for sale sign out and move to the suburbs. And Daly reversed that flow with high quality options for parents. So it was sort of a two-pronged approach that really, I think, really animated him, to your point.
Yeah, and I should point out, one of his sisters was a teacher, right?
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so that probably had a lot to do with it. And making the city more welcoming for people, he did that in a number of ways. What are the other things that he did that would draw people into Chicago or back into Chicago?
Yeah, well, he did two major things, which I think we all remember. As he did many little things, but the two big things were he was desperate to try to turn around downtown, and when he came in, there was a deep national recession, and there was no real tools available to him. And he began using TIF financing to rebuild the loop into an entertainment district. So he rehabbed all these old, you know, 100-year-old theaters that had fallen into disrepair, and supported other ones, and created the Chicago Downtown Entertainment District, which is, you know, all these playhouses, which today generate, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars for the city and thousands of jobs. And that was really the beginning point. And then, of course, in the South Loop, he in addition to sort of promoting the new cultural center there, and he built, obviously, the great Millennium Park, which is a gigantic draw. 2 years after it opened, Priceline said that it was the single most searched for destination, and 2 million people visited it. So it's an extraordinary economic engine, not just for tourism, but also it created all this development around the park in that part of the city. And you really can't emphasize enough the economic impact of that.
And we should clarify for our listeners, TIF is tax increment financing, which, right. And I'm not going to get into the explanation of how it works, but basically it's using the fact that a place is going to become worth more to pay for it, to get better. But
yeah,
it was designed for blighted neighborhoods.
Right.
How did it end up downtown?
Well, this is something I talk about in the book too, and there are some, you know, real serious critics of TIFs, like Ben Jaworski at this Reader and others who have, you know, there were abuses, and I talk about those in the book, but also there were great successes, and he was, under the state statute, it was pretty broad, and it says obsolescence or vacancy or deterioration. So if you look at a building and in your eyes it looks dilapidated or declining, then, well, it's blighted, and you go from there. So, you know, and his power, obviously, no one challenged him for the most part on that. And he was able to pretty much work his will on reclaiming certain parts of the city and rebuilding, you know, everything from businesses to new high-rise residential.
You're listening to WBBM News Radio's At Issue. I'm Craig Delamore, and we're talking with, there are too many titles, so I'm just going to say top former Daly administration stalwart, Forrest Claypool, who has written the book, The Daly Show, Inside the Transformative Reign of Chicago's Richard M. Daly. It is published by the University of Illinois Press. Let's start talking about some of the big things helped typify or helped show what his years were like, for good and bad. We've just gone through another successful Democratic National Convention after hearing, frankly, way too much about 1968. Forrest, talk about how the 1996 convention came to be and to be so successful, and what it did for the city.
Yeah, 1996 was an important year. At the time, the near west side of Chicago was, you know, basically kind of a grungy industrial hub that also had Skid Row, the city's Skid Row, and a lot of, you know, obviously a lot of poverty. It's not the west side that we see today. And two things really gave Daly an opportunity to turn that around. One was fortuitous and was presaged years earlier when the Chicago Bulls were not able to get the 2 7-foot centers they coveted in the draft and had to settle for a 21-year-old guard named Michael Jordan, which led to ultimately led to the financing and building of the United Center, which became an anchor on the West Side. And then the Democratic Convention followed on that with the United Center as the host. And Daly used that as an opportunity to completely rebuild the Near West Side and beautify it, and invested enormous amounts of money in doing so. And by the end of that process, those two things, the Near West Side became another economic engine, and it's completely transformed today with condos and restaurants and all kinds of, if we look at Fulton Market today, it's the hottest market in the city of Chicago. Back then, it had things like chicken slaughterhouses and garbage processing plants. So you can see the impact of Michael Jordan and Mayor Daly and the Democratic National Convention looking back years later.
And then having an ally like Alderman Walter Burnett Jr. In that area, that must have helped as well. I mean, he has been a force of his own.
Yeah, and I mentioned that as well in the book, that he and Terry Teal from the mayor's office were the two principal people who sort of spearheaded the efforts to clean up the Near West Side and work with community residents and business people like Ann and Lewis Costner, who were developing there when no one else would look at it. So yeah, it took a village, as they say.
Well, we've got to talk also about some of the things that where the power didn't work the way it should. Police misconduct, is this an area where the mayor's conservative anti-crime was allowed to get out of control? I mean, abuses, even torture, flourished under Daly, and has cost the city, since hundreds of millions of dollars in settlements and judgments. How did that catch hold the way it did?
Yeah, Chicago's always had a long racially charged history and history of police misconduct. He didn't create it, but he certainly didn't end it. And you're right, there was an extraordinary amount of police misconduct that occurred on his watch, including documented torture, as you mentioned, with Commander Burge. And I say in there, I think he, throughout his career, he walked a fine line between wanting to encourage aggressive policing on the street, which he knew was the key to driving violent crime down. And it did, drove it down to 40-year lows under his tenure. But at the same time, if that aggressive policing goes too far, it turns into lawlessness, and it can actually light a match as well onto the tinder of communities that feel under siege as a result of that misconduct. And there were several times when that almost occurred, and he has managed well. And I think the reason that it, unlike say Minneapolis or some other place where there were high profile police brutality incidents, in Chicago, Daly had built deep relationships, and so had Superintendent Hillard, among others, in the neighborhoods, and working closely with the people that really were the leaders in those communities. And that went a long way, I think, in diffusing issues when they arose, and also created goodwill and allowed the city to get ahead of some of these things.
As someone who was inside the administration at those times, how did Richard Daly become so close with people in the African American community and the Latino community? That didn't seem to be a natural fit.
Yeah, and when his first election, I think he got like 6% of the African American vote. And he was winning, he was winning 3 out of 4 votes across Latino, white, and black in his last three terms. So it shows you the growth of his popularity and support there. I think it's pretty simple. He just immediately, tried to diffuse racial conflicts. He worked hand in glove with minority aldermen. He actually put a disproportionate amount of the planning and investment on the South and West sides. And really worked and went out into the neighborhoods and worked with their leaders. I mean, every Saturday morning he went out into a ward, usually on the west or south side, but across the city, and sat down with ministers and leaders in the community. They go to a local McDonald's or a restaurant. They would talk about what are the issues, how can we help? And he would mobilize, and he would have an aide there taking notes, and they would follow up. And he built enormous goodwill by listening and then actually doing what he promised to do. And through his efforts, these little things built up, the little investments that build on other investments and make a community safer and better to live in.
Were there bumps in the road in building those relationships?
Well, there were some high profile instances. I talk about this in depth in the book, when at one point when Superintendent Hiller, there were two high profile shootings at the same time of African-American, young promising African-Americans by the police that almost ignited violence. Superintendent Hiller held up his fingers, you know, and showed like a gap of inches and said, this is how close we came to a full-blown riot in the city. There were moments like that had, you know, where there was problems and there was great outrage in the community and setbacks. And so there, yeah, it wasn't all smooth. It wasn't all a wonderful ride forward, but the trajectory was certainly that he made neighborhoods better. If it was turning poor neighborhoods into working class neighborhoods and working class neighborhoods into middle class neighborhoods, and even in some of the most challenged neighborhoods like Inglewood, he would find ways to make it better. In one case, he took Wright College from the north side and built a new one in Inglewood, primarily because he thought this could help stabilize the community and provide jobs and opportunities. And it didn't make Inglewood a middle-class area by any stretch of the imagination, but he never gave up on any neighborhood. And he always worked very closely with the people there who were trying to make their own community better.
Well, Forrest, we can't go over the daily years without talking about corruption. And I know you deal with that to a great degree in this book. It seemed to percolate below the fifth floor, but how did it get that way? And you know, let's first talk about that, the development of corruption and corrupt systems.
Yeah, no, this is, like I said, a theme. I mean, he had a pretty scandal-free administration for four terms, and it wasn't until really that he was at the very apex of his popularity and power that changed. And there were two scandals, one in contracting and one in patronage hiring, that were not only existential threats to his mayoralty, but actually threatened his very freedom. The former prosecutor had to hire a white-collar criminal defense attorney to sit with him as the FBI interrogated him about the corruption in his administration in the hired truck scandal and the patronage scandals. And he got through that, but it was they were two gigantic scandals that fundamentally we permeated the entire body of city politics.
But was that a case of him allowing friends or contacts to be corrupt? Or, I mean, to what extent was this stuff happening with his knowledge?
Yeah, I go into that in the book. He was a micromanager when it came to handing out the carrots of ward improvements or working with local folks, but he was not when it came to patronage, either pinstripe or day-to-day, because he, like many politicians, understand that that's often can be a an area you don't really want to have your own hands involved with. So he always had people he trusted to sort of make sure that his friends were taken care of on patronage or in contracting, but also, you know, obviously people competent enough to do that within the law, because contracting and jobs for time immemorial have been the levers of power in the city's mayor's office. And they actually are important for a mayor to have, because they're the tools that allow him to build up the power to do the things that are necessary, and also to protect the city against rearguard actions by the legislature, which is sometimes hostile. But in this instance, I think what happened is his veteran leaders, the people that had handled that for him years ago, had since moved on. And what was left was a more junior core that he felt like he didn't need advisors who were more like peers. He just needed people to take his orders. And that led, I think, to a great hubris. And in fact, those folks then carried out crimes in his name in the 2000s.
So for a final word on balance, how do we judge the Daily Decades?
I think you have to look at the fact that, yes, there were setbacks, yes, there were calamities, yes, there were scandals, but primarily what you have to see is a remarkable urban turnaround, a remarkable urban renaissance. If people forget what Chicago was like in 1989, just driven by violent crime and murders, teacher strikes every 2 years in the schools bankrupt, record dropout rates, jobs just fleeing the city in droves. And what it was when he left, but by the time he left it, the Chicago Tribune in 1981 said Chicago was an economic invalid, a city on the brink. And when Daley left office, Foreign Policy magazine ranked Chicago sixth in most important global cities in the world. It was a glistening metropolis that he left behind. Yes, not perfect, but in terms of jobs, in terms of housing, in terms of crime, and all the fundamental indicators of good governance, it was a remarkable turnaround. And there are lessons there. There are lessons there for urban leaders, too many of whom don't understand them. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to write the book, because they say that the only thing we learn from history is that we don't learn from history. But we have to, because there are lessons there that matter in cities. And I believe cities are critical to human progress, always have been, always will be. And you need to understand what makes well-governed, successful cities.
That's going to be the final word. I would like to thank Forrest Claypool for spending this half hour with us. His book is The Daily Show, Inside the Transformative Reign of Chicago's Richard M. Daley. It is published by the University of Illinois Press. To our listeners, if you'd like a copy of this program or just to hear it again, please visit our website, wbbmnewsradio.com. You can also find our podcasts on odyssey.com. We'll be back next week with another edition of At Issue, and I hope you'll be listening. Until then, I'm Craig Delamore, News Radio 105.9 WBBM. It's better
over here. AT&T customers, switching to T-Mobile has never been easier. We'll pay off your existing phone and give you a new one free, all on America's largest 5G network. Visit T-Mobile.com/carrierfreedom to switch today.
Payoff up to $650 via virtual prepaid MasterCard in 15 days. Free phone up to $830 via 24 monthly bill credits plus tax. Qualifying port and trade-in service on Go5G Next and credit required. Contact us before canceling entire account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance and required finance agreement is due.
Getting help for mental health shouldn't be as hard as it is. Mindful Therapy Group is here to make your mental health journey as painless as possible. Mindful partners with thousands of licensed clinicians to find the perfect fit for you. And also accepts insurance. Visit mindfultherapygroup.com.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Oh, 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 O'Reilly
Auto Parts. In the fast-paced world of attacking, speed is everything. And that's where the Furon 7 Plus shines. Engineered for accuracy and precision at a rapid pace, it's your secret weapon on the pitch. Experience overall comfort and precise striking, even in the game's fastest moments. The nylon outsole, with its V-shaped stud configuration, is designed for firm ground, giving you the grip you need to outmaneuver your opponents. Step up your attacking game and learn more and purchase the Furon at NewBalance.com.
It's time for Pitch Hit and Run, the official youth skills competition of Major League Baseball. Give the kids in your community a chance to flex their superpowers, and they could earn a trip to the national finals of the 2025 World Series presented by Capital One. So go ahead, be the one who powers their dreams, and sign up to host the local Pitch Hit and Run event. It's a free and fun way to promote baseball, softball, and your organization. To learn more, go to pitchhitrun.com.